Wow. Finally, when this revelation comes, the revelation being that her natural loves are really idolatrous demons, that her affection, friendship, and eros are really crushing, are really a form of hatred, Aurel is shocked. The revelation is hard on her. But you know what? The revelation is also hard on us, the reader. I haven't told you yet. The novel is written in the first person from the point of view of Orwell. And so we are complicit in all of Orwell's decisions. We don't see the palace either, except for that glimpse. And so what happens is that we are complicit. All of her choices, all of her rationalizations, we are part of it. And so the revelation hits us as well. Indeed, we watch and even join Orwell as she transforms from a maternal figure who is ready to die for Psyche into a spider who devours the lives of those she loves. Again, we are complicit in that because we're following and often rationalizing along with Orwell. Let's come back to the plot. I told you that Orwell wants to pull Psyche away from her husband. This is the way she does it. She says, "Your husband must be ugly. That's why he doesn't want you to see him. Next time he comes to you during the night, take out an oil lamp while he's sleeping. Take out an oil lamp and look at him." Well, Psyche doesn't want to do it, but she gives in for Orwell. And when she does it, a single drop of hot oil falls on the beast, who is Cupid, the god of love, falls on Cupid. He springs up in anger, rebukes Psyche, and sends her out into exile. Now, this part of the plot is exactly true to the original tale, just as it's told by Apuleius. But Lewis adds a chilling scene in which the incensed god, Cupid, appears to Orwell and tells her that she too will suffer along with Psyche. And suffer Orwell does, but not in the physical sense. Indeed, Orwell goes on to become the Queen of Gloam, and she actually rules her kingdom with justice and efficiency. She is a good queen. No, her suffering, Orwell's, comes in the form of tragic knowledge as she slowly realizes what she has done to her sister. And to try to deal with this, Orwell writes her own theodicy. Remember, A Meditation on the Justice of God? And do you know what the name of her theodicy is? Till We Have Faces. The novel is, or the first part of it, is Orwell's attempt to basically blame the gods for Psyche's exile and torment. Her reasoning being, well, if Psyche was really happy, why didn't the gods reveal this plainly to me? And so she blames the gods for her choice. Well, this is fiction. And so in the haunting finale of the novel, she, Orwell, literally gets her day in court. The gods actually allow her to come forward and lay forth her case, like a trial, before the gods. Well, Orwell does that, and it soon becomes clear, even to her, that her accusations are wrong. She did know that Psyche was happy. The gods gave her the glimpse of the palace, but even more than that, she knew what was going on. It was her fault. But her wounded affection drove her to murder Psyche's joy. And as for all of this about why don't you speak plainly to me, O ye gods? The gods' answer is, how could we speak to you? You see, like the damned souls in the great divorce, Orwell, through years of self-protection and self-deception, has so shriveled her humanity that there is hardly a person there to speak with. Or to quote the novel, how can the gods speak to us face to face till we have faces? That's where that strange title comes from. They can't talk to Orwell because there's no face there. Actually, in the end of the novel, she wears a veil to cover her ugliness, which is another metaphor. But the whole point is, until we're a human being, God cannot talk to us human to human, as it were, is what that point means. Well, as you can probably see, Orwell is Lewis's most fully conceived character. And there's a reason for that, because it's based on a real person. Orwell is patterned after Joy Gresham, C.S. Lewis's wife.